Good afternoon from the magical Isle of Bashan. This is your Captain Joe with our weekly program of From the Captain's Chair. And I am once again passing on the marcher on the grinder because I want to use the time that I have for a number of different pieces, some catching up and some new information. As always, I start the program off with a reference to the binnacle list, and I also am dilatory in my attendance on the Coast Guard channel for the last few days, and so I hasten to reassure all of my Coast Guard people that your captain is well and functioning. And I will get caught up with the Coast Guard channel here shortly, hopefully today after I get back to captain's quarters after my broadcast. The reference to the binnacle list always is of my care and concern for all of Captain Joe's people, all who listen to this broadcast all over the world on Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band and streaming worldwide voiceofvashon.org, and that I am, as always, concerned about all of my people who are on the binnacle list for problems physical, problems mental, emotional, financial, whatever they might be, and know that my hand is reaching out to you. And my hope and wish and my command from the chair is that you return back to duty and back to the loving arms of your families just as soon as possible. I've had my first vaccine shot here on the island. I talked a little bit about that last week and how well the whole process was done. And so I am encouraging everybody who has not yet had that first shot to figure out how to get into some queue and go ahead and take it. I had a wonderful telephone call during the week, and I've talked before about my first command at sea, where I was the captain of a patrol cutter out of San Diego, and I was the only officer. And I had two chiefs. Chief Alexander was my XO, my chief bosun's mate. And my chief engineer was Chief Ed Flynn. In those days, he was called an engineman, and I think now we call them a machinery technician. And I had 15 sailors, and this was a completely self-contained little ship. She was just 95 feet long, and I had 15 hands in her, plus myself as her captain. And we ranged out all over the Pacific. And one of my shipmates was a second-class gunner's mate. This little ship had a pretty formidable suite of weapons, including a 40-millimeter Bofors mounted aft. And she had a sonar. She had a full anti-submarine warfare suite, although I have to confess that probably no submarine would have been so safe if they were depending on that particular little ship to be the sole protection for the port of San Diego against any belligerent submarine. And so this second-class gunner's mate is now retired from the Coast Guard. He's now a senior chief gunner's mate, retired. And I had the wonderful phone call from him, and we were talking about the things that we learned together. I qualified him, for example, as an underway officer of the deck, which gave him responsibility for the ship and her maneuvering and her navigation for the period of his watch. And it was not customary for gunner's mates normally to be so qualified, but in small ships, everybody has to do a piece of just about everybody else's work. So we reminisced about all of that. We talked about all of that. And then I closed the conversation by saying to him that I reminded him that after that particular command, I went on to command five more Coast Guard cutters. And I said, if I had any success as a captain. If I had turned into being one of the good captains, I've used that expression because some captains are better captains than others. And I said, if I had had any success as a good captain, it was because of people like you, Guns, who helped to raise me in the path of justice and light. Now, when you have small ships, the captain messes with his crew. You get to know them. You get to know their families. At least in my commands, I got to know the families as well. And I considered the families to be part of ship's company. That was certainly the case in that little ship. And I went on to expound and to pontificate on the theme that everybody in that crew helped to teach me, and that if I'd had any success at being a good captain in later years, it started with them. And he said, well, Captain Joe, I don't know about that. And I said, well, hold on just a minute, Senior Chief. It is true. It is true. And I raise and reinforce that here, pontificating this time from the captain's chair on the magical Isle of Vashon, that every single one of those people that I sailed with, and in particular in that first little ship, helped to train me, helped to bring me up, and helped to make me, if I was a good captain, and I think I was, then it helped to make me the captain that I developed and that I learned from. But I started out with them. And the mistakes that I made were many. And the training that I got in remedying those mistakes were many hours of that kind of training. So Guns, as a second-class gunner's mate, now senior chief gunner's mate, retired, I thank you, and I thank Alex, and I thank Ed, and all of the other people that sailed in that ship with me through my first and formative years. The failure of the starboard engine in the United flight, just in the Boeing 777. I have seen the photographs that must have been absolutely chilling to people sitting on the starboard side and looking out on the wing and seeing that engine burn. And not only was it chilling, but it had to have gotten right to the very core of all of them as to whether or not they were going to survive. I'm not qualified to talk about the cause. I had a short conversation with Truman about that, but apparently the engine tried to tear itself apart from inside with possibly some blades separating from the shaft. But whatever it was, all of that will come out. But the point that I want to make is one that was made by Captain Sullenberger, who appeared on one of the news programs last night. I have great regard for Captain Sullenberger because of the way that he put that machine down into the Hudson River, saved all of his passengers, all of his crew, all of them because of his skills. And one of the things that Captain Sullenberger mentioned is something that I have believed, and in fact, one of the things that I learned in that first small ship with Master Chief, or Senior Chief, who was then a second-class gunner's mate, Ken Swore. And that was what Captain Sullenberger was talking about, was that the training and the experience that goes into bringing, in the case of that United 777, bringing that aircraft home with all hands, all crew, all passengers safe, the machine able to be examined, taken apart and examined to find out what caused it. But all of that happened not by any accident, but by experience and by training. And what Captain Sullenberger talked about at some point was the attitude that the captain of a ship, the captain of an aircraft, has to have in order to make all of those things happen. It is one of my guiding principles that I've tried to apply to every incident, puckering incident that I have had in my career and in my life. And that is, the captain shall show no fear. That doesn't mean that the captain isn't afraid. My guess is that underneath the seat of the aircraft commander, the pilot in command of that Boeing 777, is a combination yellow and brown stain. So I know that that captain was afraid. He would not be human if he weren't. But it is the training and experience that comes from the, in particular, your experience, that says that if you show fear, not that you don't have it, but if you show fear, that's going to communicate itself all the way, in the case of an airplane, all the way back to the least expensive seats, all the way aft by the galley and the aft heads. So I give a hearty Bravo Zulu to the pilot in command, the aircraft commander of that United 777, wrestling that beast back to the ground. And I know that he was afraid, and I know that he controlled that fear, and he did not show it to the people around him. So a hearty well done to him. The magazine for this week is The Professional Mariner. It is a publication which is aimed at people who go to sea for a living, and it covers a number of branches of the profession. And one of the sections in it is a section on marine casualties. And the people who write the articles about marine casualties do a really good job of it. And they do it, those articles are based on the results of the investigations, which inevitably follow after any kind of marine or aircraft casualty. So the particular one that is on the cover story for this month's Professional Mariner, is good old Golden Ray, the car carrier that is lying on her side and is now being broken up into pieces so that she can be removed from her location at St. Simons in Georgia. So I had also mentioned last week Sidelights Magazine, which is the journal of the Council of American Master Mariners. And I've been doing some diving into that one because that particular issue came out replete with just the sort of thing that I like to, things, plural, that I like to talk about from the captain's chair. So one of the articles, what I'm going to get into more in more detail in future broadcasts, because it is so, the article is so rich in good information and in particular historical information having to do with the law of the sea, the rules of the road, and how far back they go, and all thereunto pertaining. But the article from Sidelights that I'm going to mention briefly here, insofar as I can ever mention anything briefly, is that there's a piece in there on the difference between Arctic ice and Antarctic ice, and I'm adding to that Great Lakes ice. Great Lakes ice because, of course, it is all fresh water. So when you melt ice in the Arctic or the Antarctic, the ice itself is fresh water, and it precipitates out, as it freezes, it precipitates out the salt, and it forms pockets inside the ice, which are filled with brine, very highly saline water. And the difference between Arctic ice is because the Arctic is relatively shallow, and because the wind patterns and the current patterns are consistently and completely different from what they are in Antarctica, the Arctic ice, as a general rule, has more fractures, is moved around more by the wind and the currents, and has a tendency to pile up. And when ice piles up under pressure, it becomes more difficult to break. Also, some Arctic ice is multi-year ice, of course, when you get up close to the pole. And in the Antarctic, the currents and the wind patterns are different. And furthermore, the wind and currents have a much longer fetch or distance on which to work on the ice. If you look at the dimensions of the Southern Ocean, you'll see how enormous the ocean body is that is around the Antarctic continent. It is true that much Antarctic ice is multi-year ice. When I was breaking into the U.S. base at McMurdo with a ship admittedly smaller, less displacement, and lower power than Polar Star, Polar Sea, or the new icebreakers that we're going to build, that it took me 2 weeks to break about 25 nautical miles. Much of that was multi-year ice, much of it was under pressure, and it was as thick as 14, 15 feet. That's back in ram country. That's back off. You ram into it, right up on the ice, break a lead open, get into that lead, back in ram, 24 hours a day. So the freshwater ice, first of all, freezes at a higher freezing temperature. It does not have to go quite, doesn't have to be subcooled as much as saltwater ice. And it will also refreeze very quickly. So when you're breaking ice in the Great Lakes, depending on the lake, for example, Lake Erie is that paella pan that about which we spoke last week. And that ice is not particularly thick, but if it is very, very cold, as we have had some very cold temperatures this winter, it will refreeze very quickly, and so you have to keep everybody moving. I have taken a convoy of loaded ore boats from Duluth to the Cleveland area, the south shore of Lake Erie, where the steel mills are, taking a convoy where the captains were all complaining about working under the lights in the dark. They didn't like to do it. I didn't like to do it. It's really dangerous work. But in the wintertime in the Northern Hemisphere, you have to work under the lights sometimes. So I listened to their whining for long enough, and I finally said, okay, we're going to pull over to the side of the channel and let you freeze in, and that way you'll be able to see what happens. So this was on one of the earlier convoys in the season, and I had captains who this was their first convoy and the first time that they'd worked in the ice, and they were not a happy group. They were not a happy band of captainly warriors, and so I let them freeze in. And then it took me the whole day, the next day, to get everybody moving again. And I said, that's it. You've seen what happens, and now I'm not going to allow that to happen again. So there are differences in Baltic ice. Baltic ice, the Baltic, of course, is relatively shallow, and the salinity levels are different in different parts of the world. Those have a bearing on when it freezes and how hard it is. So there are a number of factors. But essentially, it is a matter of brute force. Brute force where you back out, back into the water that you have opened, and then you go ahead, all ahead full, and slam into it, and you keep on doing that until you get to your destination. So I had a couple of questions about the differences among the three kinds of ice. I have now hopefully explained that to everybody's satisfaction. One of the things that has happened during the week was that my daughter Gina, who lives in Bend, found a reference to an organization or a program or a series of blogs. I'm not sure exactly how you refer to these, which is called shipreport.net. And shipreport.net is homeported in Oregon. And I called, so when she gave me this reference, I called it up. I found that there is a gal named Joanne who runs shipreport.net. If you go on to the website, you will see how frequently she does broadcasts. She does a very short broadcast every day about conditions on the Columbia River Bar. Anybody who lives in the Pacific Northwest, or anybody who is interested in ships and shipping, or anybody who is interested in Pacific Northwest history, would do well to visit Joanne on shipreport.net. And she also sells a little brochure about shipping in the Pacific Northwest. I have ordered a copy of that. When it shows up, I will do a book review, a folder review, a brochure review, whatever the hell it is. So the book today is, we talked about the book called Tom Crean, and I'm going to go back into Tom as we get to some more significant anniversary dates for the events during the golden age of exploration, the Shackleton and Scott and Amundsen expeditions. And the but the book today is called Ship. Not The Ship, just Ship. Actually, to be more precise, it is published by the Smithsonian, so it is called Smithsonian Ship. The interesting, and the subtitle is The Epic Story of Maritime Adventure. The significant thing about this particular book is, first of all, it is beautifully produced. I have the paperback edition of it, which was published in 2010. But the person who put this book together is a man by the name of Brian Lavery. Now, Brian is curator emeritus for the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, England, on the River Thames. And it is in the same place where the marker for the prime meridian, from which all longitude in the world is measured. And the story about that is an interesting one, which is beyond the scope of what we have time for today, but we'll talk about it some more. The whole subject of how we measure longitude and how we are able to determine our longitude is a fascinating piece of world history, political history as well. And so we'll talk about that in a future broadcast. But Brian was one of the curators for the museum, which is located in the same place as the marker for the Prime Meridian. He's written a number of other books, and he is as well known among people who follow maritime history as, for example, the late and much admired Frank O. Brainard, who wrote books about the liners, or I can't think right now who might be in that same category who is still alive. Frank, of course, is no longer with us. He's crossed his own bar. So I recommend Ship. I recommend that you... either if you get it from the library, from your library, if your library is open, I suspect are not, but if you can find it, and it is the kind of book that if you are interested in this program, if you are one of Captain Joe's people, and you're interested in the things about which we discuss and talk on this program, you're going to want to have your own copy of Ship. I am not even a quarter of the way through it, and I find that I skip through it, and I find also that I go to the index. It's very well indexed. I go to the index if I'm interested in a particular subject, and Brian almost certainly has covered it. It is beautifully produced. It is beautifully illustrated. It has a huge number of photographs There is so much good material in here that no matter how much time you have left before you cross your own bar, or I have left before I cross my own bar, I'm never going to get to the end of it. It is that highly recommended. So the I've decided to delve quickly into a political subject. And the political subject is that we have heard a lot of politicians recently in the last, in particular in the last year, who want to talk themselves about COVID, or they want to talk about any number of different things depending on their party affiliation and their political convictions. And the amount of chatter is incredible, almost to the level of my own, it must honestly be reported. So one of the terms that came up, has come up, is a reference to a person as being the number three or number four person in a particular political party. And he's referred to as the whip. And so I thought that maybe some people accept, like we accept so many other terms without really understanding from whence they came, what the term whip means. And here's what it means. And it goes back at least to the House of Commons in the British Parliament. In the British Parliament, it goes back centuries. And the whip is the, for those of you shipboard types, the master at arms for the political party in that particular house. So there is a Democratic whip in the House of Representatives, and there is a Republican whip. And the whip is responsible for keeping all members of that political party on board when it is time to take a vote, to make sure that everybody is voting for or against, depending on what the political leadership decides is the way the vote should go on that particular subject or that particular matter. So sometimes a member will not accept the whip, and he or she then runs the risk of being at least censured or possibly even dropped from party affiliation, which means dropped from financial help and dropped from political help. So the whip is if you go on to some broadcasts of the British House of Commons in Westminster, and you will hear the expression that sometimes the a party is allowed to vote the way that they really want to vote it according to their conscience. We've had a couple of votes like that recently in both our Senate and our House of Representatives, where the members were told that they could vote the way that they wanted. In other words, they do not accept the whip. So knowing how fascinated all of us are, and knowing that we have now come to 1300 hours, and knowing that I have come to the end of my time once again, and knowing that there are a number of things that I wanted to talk about and do not have time for, we'll get to next week or weeks after that, it remains then for me, as always, to say how important From the Captain's Chair is to me for my mental and emotional health, and hopefully it is something that you look forward to every week. If you are responsible for other people, make sure that you are taking care of those for whom you are accountable and responsible. Watch the six of all of those that you love and care about. And know that your captain is up in the captain's chair.